All right. So for the first talk, I gave you sort of an overview of zero CFA, three ways to compute it. For the second talk, we went more in depth into KCFA in particular, you know, a family of higher order control flow analyses. And for this third talk, I want to sort of take two angles. First, I want to show you how to efficiently implement the small step CFAs, which I promised you were sort of a universal framework for CFA. And then I want to take you beyond control flow analysis into, you know, analyses that are strictly outside the reach of a control flow analysis. But I do have one clarification to make and some immediate follow-up points for it. So some people were asking me if I meant to say that KCFA was the unique solution to the constraints I presented last time. That's not what I meant to imply. There are many different analyses you can plug into the KCFA framework by changing the allocation function and the tick function. And once you choose, what becomes determined is when you pick either an allocation function or you pick an abstraction function, they co-determine each other. So if you have an abstraction function or if you have an allocation function, you've automatically got the other. And what I was pointing out was that for KCFA, I chose a particular allocation function and a particular tick function, and then immediately determined what my abstraction map was. And I guess one of the morals for today is best summed up by a quote by Alan Perlis. And what he said was that for every polynomial time algorithm you have, there's an exponential time algorithm I would rather run. And this is one of the constants I found to be true in static analysis, that, again, the worse I make the complexity of my analyses, the better they run in practice. And so what I'll try to convince you of today is that just because an algorithm is exponential, you shouldn't run away from it. You should just try it out and see how it does. But if you do need hard guarantees of polynomial time, there are ways to achieve them. So broadly, the objectives are cover two more CFAs. These are two more solutions to the constraints I presented last time. Probably the two most popular ones, two most useful ones. Then I'll show you how to implement small step CFAs as efficiently as you can. This will give you cubic time zero CFA. And then, because I told you at the very first lecture that everything I've been doing so far would apply as well to object-oriented languages, I'll reformulate KCFA, or at least a sketch of it, for Java, and for Featherweight Java in particular. So if you've been tuning out because all you saw was lambdas, that'll be the time to tune back in because it'll be relevant to you again. Then I'll show you techniques for improving the precision of KCFA, or really any CFA, called abstract garbage collection. And then I'll show you how to go beyond KCFA in terms of power through something called abstract counting, which will drive what I call environment analysis. And we'll close that out with showing you some optimizations you can do with KCFA, or all CFAs in general, really. So the two additional CFAs I want to show you, so I had a slide early on where I talked about a decade-long period where people played with different values of K. Well, what people were really doing was playing with different allocation functions. And out of that period, two very useful kinds of allocation functions came out. So I want to show you what those are in case they're relevant to the kinds of programs that you're analyzing. So the first is poly-CFA. So this was found by Wright and Jagannathan some time ago. And it's probably the best CFA in the classical sense that you can run on a functional program. It really is designed for running on modern functional programs. It's inspired by the way let-bound polymorphism works in the Hindley-Miller type system, and it achieves the effects of monomorphization, inlining all your let-bound functions, without actually doing that. And it tends to be much more faster and much more precise than zero CFA, even though it's got a far worse time complexity. And if you look at the mechanics of it, all you're really doing is getting an analysis that seems to be somewhere between 0 and 1 CFA. So your set of abstract times is the set of call sites, and which is what you would use for 1 CFA, plus this little singleton time that you would use for 0 CFA. And then when you're making a call, when you want to allocate the next time, if what you're invoking is a let-bound function, then you give it the call site. And if what you're invoking is not a let-bound function, then you give it, you know, the zero CFA singleton time. And this exploits a property of or behavior of functional programs that tends to work out pretty well in practice. And that behavior is that if you look at where the higher orderness comes in, a lot of it's from library functions, you know, map, folder, things like this. So these are all let-bound, and there's a lot of other let-bound functions which also tend to be higher order. So if you inline all of those once, then they're going to see the function they get used with. And so that's why this tends to work out very well in practice. It's the first existence proof I know of for CFAs where precision and speed got better together. With poly-CFA, you shouldn't, according to the worst-case complexity, but in practice, you tend to get higher precision and higher speed out of poly-CFA. And the other one is a little more useful for object-oriented programs, but it also applies to functional programs. And this is called the Cartesian Product Algorithm, or CPA. And this is actually, so this really, I think it now refers to sort of a family of techniques that all share a common philosophy. And that philosophy is, you know, letting the next abstract time be some combination of information from the arguments to that particular call site. And I think one of the simplest things you can do is just use the types. So if you let abstract times be a vector of types, when you're invoking a function, you can just look at the arguments there and just allocate all their types as an abstract time. And this is, you know, philosophically one way to instantiate CPA. And this tends to work reasonably well in stuff like object-oriented programs. Okay. So now on to actually implementing these small step CFAs efficiently. So first we're going to focus on zero CFA, and we're going to see how inefficient it is, and then fix that. Then we'll take that same fix and apply it to one CFA. So the nice thing about small step abstract interpretation for a CFA is that it's really easy to implement. In fact, let me just show you how easy it is to implement a small step CFA with some actual code. So that's this code right here is the transition relation for a small step CFA for CPS. It's about 15 lines. It's really not that much at all. And there's about 200 lines surrounding it, but most of that's like graph search. It's really not complicated stuff. So this is one of the reasons I really like the small step approach. The implementation is small. For every syntactic construct you add to your language, you're going to add maybe 3 or 4 lines of code to your CFA. So it scales pretty well. The bad part about small steps analysis is that to implement it efficiently, it does require some effort and some thought. So just to remind ourselves of what I mean by a small step analysis, the way you run a zero CFA in a small step mode is you start off with your program, and you inject it into some initial abstract state. You've got this abstract transition relation, and you just explore all the reachable structure beginning with this initial abstract state. And you explore until you loop back on yourself, because you don't need to explore anymore after here, or until you reach some sort of natural abstract halt state. And once you've sort of searched out all this reachable structure, you take that, and that's, I showed you a way to compact that down into the flows two set, and that's the result of your analysis. The problem with this approach is that it's far too complex to actually use in practice, or at least it looks that way. You can run this approach in practice, and oftentimes it works out pretty well. The problem is if you hard bounds on how long it's going to take, this is not for you, because the complexity is doubly exponential in the number of lambda terms and then variables. And that's because every state is dragging around its own store, and those stores can be very large. So it can take you a really long time, in theory, to search out that whole space. In practice, these things tend to be pretty sparse, so that usually won't happen. But if you can't take the risk, then I'll show you some things you can do. So there's a couple standard techniques. One of them works very well for taming exponential algorithms in practice. The other one will actually get it down to polynomial time. So the first thing you can do is exploit the fact that most transition relations are monotonic, most abstract transition relations, that is. And what I mean by that is that if you're in some abstract state and you transition to some other abstract state, if you were to move to a less precise abstract state from the one you started transitioning with, then there must exist some path or there must exist some transition such that if you came down from here and found a less abstract state, you could get to it. Now, you have to prove that your transition relation actually has this property. Virtually all of them do. It's never really much of an issue. But if you've got that property, then it allows you to do some sort of early termination during the search of the abstract state space. So if this is a chunk of the abstract state space that you've already searched out, so you've hit some state already, it's got some successors, and then you continue searching, and at some point later on in the analysis, you arrive at this state, and you happen to notice that this state is more precise or weaker than this state up here, then you don't actually have to keep going. And that's because however you might leave that state, whatever this is, it's already covered by one of these. So you just don't bother exploring at all. If you need to construct the true flow graph, you would come to here and then immediately sort of teleport up to here if you wanted to know what the possible successors were. So this doesn't actually change the complexity of the analysis. It could still be exponential, but in practice, this gives you about a square root speed up in terms of time. At least that's what I've noticed empirically. But if you need to crunch it down further, then you really have to sort of rethink how we're executing the algorithm as a whole. And to do this, I want to bump up a level and look at the system state space, the state space of the entire algorithm. So what we're really doing is we're building this set of reachable states. So we can view the state space, in this case in the concrete, as a set of states. And then we can reimagine the concrete semantics as a function which takes us from one set of states to the next set of states. So one nice thing about this is that, you know, now we are dealing with a function. So there's no non-determinism at this point. And that lack of non-determinism is going to carry over into the abstract as well. And we can construct that transition function using the transition relation that we've already been using. All we do is, when we're given a set, is look at all the states in that set and move each of them forward once. Then to ensure that we've got the reachable states in there, we throw in the initial concrete state. So if we just keep running this over and over and over again, we may not, if it doesn't terminate, we won't reach a fixed point. But there is an infinite set which exists as a fixed point because this is monotonic. And we can do the same trick in the abstract state space, where instead of thinking of moving from state to state to state, moving from one set of states to another set of states. So our system space for the algorithm is a set of states, and our transfer function or transition function just takes us from sets of abstract states to sets of abstract states. Okay. Now this alone isn't going to buy us what we need, but it's the right way of thinking about the problem to get to the solution. And again, we can encode this function using the transition relation we already have. We just take all the, when we're given an argument, we look at all the states inside of there, we bump them forward once, and we throw in the initial abstract state. So we know we're dealing with reachable structure. Okay. So now how do we manipulate this to get down from that exponential into cubic time? Well, if you look at zero CFA, this is the system state space. It's a set of call sites paired with stores. Now, one thing we can realize is that we can approximate any set of stores by taking their least upper bound. And so instead of carrying around an individual store with every single call site, we can just say, approximate all of those stores with their least upper bound. And so now we have one store for the entire system space. So we are losing a little bit of precision. But as it turns out, the small step zero CFA, if you implement it literally as a small step, is more precise than the constraint-based zero CFA. But this will take us down toward the precision we would get from something like a constraint-based CFA. Yeah, so now we have just a single abstract store. And the transition function we want to use now looks like this. So what it's going to get in is a set of call sites we've seen so far and some aggregate abstract store, summing over all the abstract stores we've seen up to this particular point. So we take all the call sites we've seen so far, and we pair them with our one giant abstract store, and we step all of them forward. So we get a set of new states back out of that. We look at those new states, and we want to find out what call sites we've seen. We pull out all the call sites from the states we just got to. And then, for the next state, we throw in those call sites with the call sites we've already seen. To get the new abstract store, we pull out all of the stores from the set of successor states and join them together. Now, this isn't how you would implement this in practice. This is a functional specification. The way you'd implement this in practice is using a hash table for the store. Now, there's only one store in your algorithm. You don't ever actually have to join with it. So if you just implement your store as a hash table, this operation becomes unnecessary and saves you a lot of time in practice. And the nice thing about this is that this will get us to a fixed point in a cubic number of applications of the transition relation. And this particular variant of it is flow sensitive. And what I mean by that is it actually will skip around dead code if it can, because it's not going to consider all call sites. It's only going to consider call sites that somehow a path to them. So it's a mildly flow-sensitive analysis in some sense. And if you want to make it flow-insensitive and just consider all the call sites, then you would start off with this particular global abstract state. You would just start off with all the call sites in the program, regardless of whether or not you can reach them in the call set. And the complexity of this is still cubic. And the way I like to tell myself that the complexity of this algorithm is cubic is by looking at the system space and consider what's happening to the system space. So for the flow insensitive version, all we're really doing is just building up a store. And a store in CPS just maps a variable to a set of lambda terms. So all we're really doing as we run this, analysis is just flipping bits in this table. And once a bit flips on, it's never going to flip off because we're monotonic. So this is what the algorithm looks like as it runs. It's just filling in slots in this table. And there's only, the number of slots you have to fill is variable, the number of variables times the number of lambda terms. So that's n squared, but it could take up to n transitions to flip an individual bit, so that's where the qubit comes from. Okay. So there are other ways to refactor the state space. So there's a per-point refactoring, where instead of having just a single store, you have one store summing over all of, or joining over all of the stores you've ever seen at a particular call site. So now you can think of this as if for every call site in your program, stick a new abstract store there. Stick one of those tables next to every single abstract call, or next to every single call site. Now the complexity of this, just based on how many bits we have to fill in, is quartic, which is not too bad. It's still technically efficient. And what I've often found is that in practice, this will give me better precision and better speed than the cubic version. Again, this is coming back to this whole, if you want to get better speed, you may have to get significantly better precision so that you can cut off the false positives, which sort of pollute the analysis. The punchline of some of this stuff is that the expensive CFAs, while the behavior is bounded, and it's bounded in an efficient amount of time, they're not always faster. They're certainly going to be less precise. And the reason for that is if you actually just executed the program and looked at the flow graph or the flows two sets, they tend to be very sparse. You shouldn't have to flip too many bits to get to the optimal flow graph. So the more precision you get, the less bit flipping you're going to do in those tables. So now let's see what happens when we take this same technique and apply it to one CFA. And this technique, by the way, is described in Olin Shiver's dissertation. So if you need a more technical reference for it, that's where it is. Oh, the technique of just sort of joining it together, all the stores into one. He called it the timestamp algorithm for historic reasons. But if you look for the timestamp algorithm, what it's really doing is just merging all these stores together. So here's the system space for one CFA. We've got a set of states, each of which contains a call site, binding environment, and a store. So we could try the same trick where we merge all of the stores together. So now we've got just one giant store for one CFA. And it helps, for the sake of visualizing the algorithm, if instead of thinking of this as sets of pairs, we reimagine this as a map from call sites into sets of binding environments that appear with those call sites. Because now what we really got here is two tables. We can look at this as a table. We can look at this as a table. We can look at how many bits we have to flip, in the worst case, to completely fill that table. So that first table is up here. It's got call sites on one side and binding environments associated with that call site on the other. And down here is the store. Stores map addresses into closures. So it's telling us for every address the set of closures which might be associated with that address. So if we want to get a rough idea of how many times we might have to flip these bits, we can just do the combinatorics, and this is what we get back. And so if we add up all the bits in that table and this table, we end up with a double exponential. So it's still technically not efficient, but in practice, you can often run it. So if you're actually implementing this stuff, what I would recommend to you is if you're looking for something to do with all the cores you've got, run three different control flow analyses. Run the classic cubic zero CFA, run the small step zero CFA, and run one CFA. And whichever one terminates first, use that one. Very often, you might actually get a reasonably high precision analysis out of that. So this is the argument, Giannis, for why one CFA, at least this version, is exponential.
Okay, I think I need to understand this a lot better. But when you flip this, you can never flip them back, right?
You can never flip them back, absolutely.
So it's only a polynomial number of bits, right? In the space, state space you showed before, or not?
No. So exponential, because when you multiply this by this, there's an exponential here. And there's an exponential here because we've got functions inside there. So it's like inside this table, there's functions, and those things explode. So that's where the problem comes in. And if you didn't have free variables, or you had one free variable, the problem would go away. So now I want to take an excursion and do KCFA for Java. So like I said, if you've been sleeping through the Lambda stuff, because you're a more applied guy, this is the stuff you want to pay attention to. As it turns out, this may be novel research. I just assumed it had been done, but now there's some debate about whether or not KCFA for Java has actually been done. So what I'm going to show you is if Olin Shivers in 1988 had been working with Featherweight Java instead of the Lambda calculus, this is what he would have done instead. And I'll work with Featherweight Java just because it's nice and small. I hope most of you have seen Featherweight Java. If not, it's just a really tiny subset of Java. And one of the ways I'm trying to argue that it is in fact what Olin Shivers would have produced is through the structure of the state space. So one of the reasons I did animal form was not necessarily because you should use animal form. I think that the tide really is turning towards CPS again in terms of functional compilation, but because animal form shows you how to deal with a stack when you're dealing with these machines. And once you know that trick once, you can apply it to every direct style language you encounter. So for Java, we're going to do exactly the same trick. Into the state space, we add this continuation pointer component that tells us where we need to go when we've got a value. Now, because Java hasn't sort of normalized evaluation, we do have to deal with contexts. I could come up with a subset of Featherweight Java that actually normalized evaluation that we wouldn't have to deal with context. It would be exactly like animal form, but I wanted to work directly with Featherweight Java as it is. So up here, instead of some sort of body or expression, we have what I call a value expression. And you'll notice it's got sort of the syntactic font, but it's got a little abstract hat on it. So value expressions are hybrid syntactic semantic values. And they have the parsing structure of expressions. And I'll get to those in a moment on the next slide. And of course, since we're dealing with object-oriented stuff, values include abstract objects. And I'm not going to bother giving you the concrete semantics, of course. If you want the concrete semantics, set k equal to infinity and simplify. So an object is a class paired with a binding environment. I could probably call this a record, but I've already got a structure that does the same thing, and it's called a binding environment, so I'm reusing it right here. And then for continuations, we have an abstract context, which is related to this value expression, and it tells us the binding environment to resume in and the continuation pointer to finish off or to go to once we've got a value for this particular abstract context. And just to show you that it really is a lot like the animal form, here's the state space for animal form. Side by side. And what you can tell is that, the structure is almost identical. The big difference, really the only structural difference, is in continuations here. Over here, in animal form, the order of evaluation is normalized. We only have one context. So that context is inline directly in continuations. Over here, it's true direct style. We might evaluate things in different order. So this context is going to tell us the order in which we evaluate sub-expressions. But that's really a cosmetic detail. It's not fundamental to the algorithm itself. So those value expressions, like I said, they're hybrid semantic syntactic entities. So it looks exactly like an expression from here down. The difference is at the roots, you can have both variables and you can have semantic values. So this d hat is an abstract denotable value. So that it allows you to have something that's part expression, and also as you evaluate that expression, you can fill in the values you got for sub-expressions. And eventually, as you simplify this entire expression, you get down to just a single value, which is some sort of return value. Okay. To create the continuations, we're actually going to need a one-hole context to help us tell which expression to do next inside the continuation. And this particular one-hole context enforces left-to-right evaluation and bottom-up evaluation of an expression. So this is saying we have to evaluate the leftmost argument first. Once we evaluate it inside here, then we can actually do the field dereference. So I'm not going to do all the rules for Featherweight Java, but I'll do about half of them so you get the idea. The other ones are pretty easy to construct once you've got these. So the sort of generic evaluation rule says, you've got some value expression, and somewhere in that value expression is an unevaluated sub-expression. What we want to do is evaluate that sub-expression, get back an abstract denotable value, and drop it in here. Ultimately, that's what we want to do. So to do that, we're going to immediately transition to a state which is evaluating this expression. And we're going to evaluate it in the context of the same environment we're already in. Then we're going to update the store and the current continuation pointer to have a pointer to a continuation that will resume evaluation in the context we're in once we have a value. So the continuation we create is right here. This continuation says, once you've got a value, stick it in this context, and then continue execution. And right here, we've got the binding environment that we want it to continue execution in, and we've got the continuation to resume that once we've got the value. So we allocate space for the continuation, install the continuation in the store. Again, we have to use join so we don't overwrite anything. And then we just move time forward. So this is the basic evaluation rule. It's a little more complicated because we're dealing with contexts, but not that much more complicated. It's mostly a cosmetic change. Method invocation, again, it's a little hairier because we've got inheritance and things like that to deal with. Although I abstract those issues out and use helper functions, which you could infer to be the abstractions of stuff you'll find in the Igarashi paper on Featherweight Java. So for a method call, we have to figure out what method M is. So for that, I've got a helper function. We're going to give this helper function the object we're invoking off of, and this particular method call site right here. So that's enough information to figure out some bound on the set of methods we might be invoking here. Then we look at this at each method that we're invoking, and we're going to transition to the body of that method for continuing evaluation. So that the next expression we're going to evaluate comes out of the body of each of the methods we're invoking. So obviously, whenever you see this, this means the rule is not deterministic. So we could be forking to many subsequent states at this point, depending on what that gives us back. At this point, we need to allocate all of the addresses to assign to the variables we're about to give values to. And once we've allocated those addresses, we can extend the binding environment, which maps variables into values. So one little hack I use is I use this as a literal variable, and I just have it bound immediately to the object we're invoking on, so that we have access to this in the scope of the method. And for each variable, I assign it to the address we've allocated to this point right here. After that, we just throw them in the store and move time forward. So this is method call. Again, it's a little hairier, but it's still the same spirit as what we were looking at for anormal form. For object allocation, it's a little bit hairy, but again, it's mostly just sort of cosmetic hairiness. So when we want to create an object, we're going to look up the constructor for that object using this magic calligraphic C hat function. And what it gives us back is a helper function and two numbers. So the first number, n, is telling us how many arguments does this constructor take. The second number, m, is telling us how many fields do we need to allocate to hold all the data for this object. So then what we do is we invoke this k-hat helper function. We give it all the arguments to this constructor, and we also give it all the addresses it needs to complete creating the object. What it gives us back is sort of the change to the store that we need to introduce. All the stuff, all the bindings to the field that were created as the result of running this constructor, and the record or the binding environment is going to go along with the class to create the object. So we allocate all of the addresses that we need for the fields, and then we invoke the k-hat function. We give it all the arguments that are being passed into this constructor. We give it all the addresses it needs to create the fields, and it gives us back the change to the store to introduce these fields and the record that goes along in the object. So we introduce that change to the store. We create that object in the abstract. We move time forward, and then what we give back, the next thing we execute, is an atomic value. And that's going to cause a return to whatever our current continuation is. So we have this return state here. And if what you're evaluating is exactly a value, there's nothing further to evaluate, you have to give that to whatever your current continuation or continuations are. So we look up the current continuation using the pointer. We get back a set of these things, and we have to pass in to that context the value it was expecting. The value we just got is a return value. And once we do that, we just bump time once, and we're done. So hopefully from this you believe that all the stuff I taught you does in fact apply to Java as well, and that it's really a very direct port over to this stuff. And I'm sure if Roz were here, he would tell us that his sketching tool could fill in the little dot, dot, dots for what you should give to the tick and alloc functions. Next, actually, it probably could. So now what I want to do is tell you about what to do if the analysis you're running is not running either fast enough or precise enough for the task at hand. And this is one of the big hammers I came up with in my dissertation, and it's very powerful in this regard. It's called abstract garbage collection. And one of the reasons I like it is the idea is really stupid. All you do is add garbage collection to a concrete semantics. Now, why on earth would you add garbage collection to a semantics? I mean, it's not going to change the meaning of the semantics at all. Well, it goes back to the way you do abstract interpretation. You know, you fiddle with the abstraction function a little bit, and you know, ultimately when you can't fiddle with it anymore and you just can't get the precision you want, you go back and you change the semantics. So at one point, I was inspired to add garbage collection and then do the abstract interpretation. And this gave me a very different analysis back. And originally, all I wanted to do was jack up precision. In reality, it actually jacked up precision and speed and jacked them up by orders of magnitude. So I always like to illustrate how abstract garbage collection works with a little example. So what we're going to do is step through some sequence of execution on a really small machine. You won't see the instructions we're executing. I'm just going to tell you sort of what's happening, and you're going to see a visual representation of what's going on in terms of both a concrete and an abstract store. So on this left-hand side over here, what we've got is a concrete store. On this right-hand side, we've got an abstract store that's somehow modeling the concrete store. So this one has three addresses. This one has two addresses. That's why this one's abstract. And clearly, this address right here is going to copy or cover for both of these addresses. So anything that happens to one of those has to happen to this address. And when we move into this example, two objects will have already been allocated. Well, really one. We're going to have allocated this one object over here in the concrete represented by this doom marine. This doom marine represents some kind of closure. And because the abstract has to simulate the concrete, we have to have the abstraction of that guy allocated over here. So that's what that one is. And that tells us that, you know, this guy's this doom marine is the abstraction of that doom marine, and this address is the abstraction of that address. And when we're going to do work with garbage collection, we have to have a notion of a root set where we begin our search to find what the reachable addresses are. So I'll use these red circles to indicate whatever the root set is at any given moment in execution. So right now, these objects are obviously reachable because they're both on the root set. So to start things off, we're going to allocate a new object down here. And after we allocate that object, we're going to have to mirror it over here. So when we do that, it looks like this. Now, it wouldn't do us a whole lot of good to allocate objects and not be able to see them. So we're going to also move the root set from these addresses down to these addresses and watch what happens to the marines. They're dead. They're dead from the perspective of garbage collection because we can't reach them anymore. You know, from here, all we can reach is this object. There's no path up to that one. So they're dead. And I think now we're ready to get into trouble. So now what we're going to do is allocate another object to this middle address. We're going to mirror that allocation over here. And because we want to make it useful, we're going to have this guy point to that address. So whatever we allocate here will still be reachable. And just watch what happens to the supposedly dead objects as we do that. So we allocate the concrete, allocate the abstract, make the pointers, and now he's a zombie. So why is he a zombie? He's a zombie because there's no path over here that gets us to that object, but there is a path over here that gets us to that object. We can get from here to here to here to here. So he's reachable again. You know, in abstract interpretations, things can come back to life. Previously unreachable objects can become reachable again as you reuse old addresses. You know, if those old addresses were dead and you reuse them and they had stuff attached to them, you can see the stuff again. So, you know, a simple way to remedy something like this is to just run garbage collection in both the concrete and in the abstract. And you have to run it in both or else you'll lose simulation. So we can step back to before we had this loss in precision, run abstract garbage collection and concrete garbage collection, and then rerun that last step. And when we do that, we have visually sort of symmetry between the concrete and the abstract, and we can tell we just haven't lost any precision. So it's a very simple hack, but it goes a long way. So just to give you an example of what this can do in practice, this is the state graph I showed you several days ago for a doubly nested loop. It's less than 10 lines long. It just happens to make use of higher orderness in the middle. Because you happen to make use of higher orderness in the middle of the loop, you get this disastrously complex control flow graph back. You can't possibly tell that's a doubly nested loop once you throw a little bit of higher orderness in there. So then what you do is you regenerate the graph using abstract garbage collection, and this is what you get back. You know, and you can look at that and you can tell that probably was a doubly nested loop. And it takes a lot less time to generate that than the one before. So what's really going on here is we're taking a vicious cycle in which we've got merging, you know, this join operation. Every time you see join, you're losing precision. You're folding things together. And every time you fold things together, there's the chance that this will cause the analysis later on to fork. If you invoke procedures you have merged together, you will fork. You will have multiple subsequent abstract states. And some of those are going to head on into spurious state space. As you head on into spurious state space, you could introduce further imprecision. You can introduce further merging. So we're taking this vicious cycle and flipping it around, turning it into a virtuous cycle. What we're doing is we're preventing the merging from ever happening in the first place. And when we don't merge, we don't fork. When we don't fork, things that would have merged never merge at all. And we're still tightening up things with abstract garbage collection to prevent even further merging. So you get this feedback cycle where precision and speed really feed on each other. And you know, again, the net impact of this is that you get, in practice, orders of magnitude speedups in the amount of time it takes to run the analysis. It makes the small step CFAs, in many cases, significantly faster than any of the cubic or any of the polynomial time CFAs. Again, technically the complexity isn't any better; it's still exponential, but it gets much, much faster in practice. And so, I'd also like to show you that it's not that hard to implement this stuff. There's only a small amount of machinery involved. It's a very simple addition to an existing small step abstract interpretation. So all we really need is this abstract garbage collection function. You give it an abstract state, it gives you back an abstract state, and all it's going to do is look for the reachable structure of this state, or all the reachable addresses in the state, and restrict the store to solely the reachable addresses. So it's just going to discard anything we can't reach. So to define this, we need this reachability function right here. So for that reachability function, we look in the current state, and we find all, you know, it's just going to give us back the set of addresses it can reach. To find those, it's going to look in the root set, which we now have to define, and it's going to walk over some reachability relation until it's found all the addresses which are reachable. So now we need to define the root set and this reachability relation that goes from address to address. So for the root set, there's a couple different ways to define this, but I think the simplest and most obviously correct one is to define it in terms of the binding environment inside the current state. So what the root set is asking for is what are all the addresses which could somehow be used in some way from this state. And you know, and by use, I mean you could close over them, create a closure over them, or directly pass them in as a value to the next function. So of course, those are the free variables of this call site, but it's most certainly whatever the range of this binding environment is. You can't get to more addresses from one transition through this state than whatever's inside this binding environment. So you can use the range. You can also use the range restricted to the free variables. There are some trade-offs in doing one or the other. But this is definitely a safe thing to do. And then we need that reachability relation. So that relation is the least reflexive transitive relation such that this condition holds. And what this condition is saying is if we've got some address and we look it up in a store, it'll give us back some closures. And if we look in the environment of one of those closures and we can get to another address, then this address can reach that address. And that's what this relation is saying. So this allows us to trace out the reachable addresses of any given state. So this is sort of like the, you know, the purely declarative version of some sort of like mark and sweep collector. It's just wandering over the state space looking for what it can actually reach. Or I guess it's more like a stop and copy. And it's also easy to see how this actually impacts the execution of a program using that standard example we've been using over and over and over again. So we can look at this example again for zero CFA and then look at it again with abstract garbage collection enabled. So when we start off, what I want to do is just track the values associated with X. So at this point, X has never been bound. All we've done is create the identity function, and so X has nothing in it. When we finally get to this point right here, X has been bound because we went through the identity function. X got bound to 3. So that gets recorded in the abstract state as saying that 3 is in the set flow set for X. By the time we get to here, because we can't take this out, you know, these stores increase monotonically, we've now got 3 and 4 in here. Now, the thing to note, of course, is that between these invocations of the identity function, You know, X was just a local variable. It has a very short lifetime. It's alive and then it's dead. So a garbage collector could throw something like that away. There's no reason to keep it around. So if you run this with abstract garbage collection, by this point, again, X has nothing. When you get down to here, after the full execution of the identity function, X has nothing again. That address got thrown away. It wasn't reachable, got discarded. So at this point, A gets bound to just the singleton set 3. When we get down to here, and by the way, if this were in CPS, it would do the same thing for the continuation of the identity function. So we're also going to avoid this, you know, spurious return flow problem. Again, after the second invocation of the identity function, X is eligible for garbage collection, so it gets collected. And because during the evaluation of this identity function, X had nothing bound to it when we started, when we came out, we got exactly what went in. So B now has just 4 sitting inside its flow set. So we got, yep.
How often the garbage collector is run here?
So there's actually a couple options. So you could say run it every state, every transition. Empirically, doesn't actually make that much of a difference on performance. The amount of collecting it has to do tends to be very small. It's not like these heaps can actually get very, very big in practice and you spend a lot of time walking over them. But even that's pointless. You don't need to run it every single state. What you can do is just check, am I about to merge values? If the answer is yes, then it might be beneficial to run the collector. But as long as you're not about to merge values, you can delay collection as long as you want. So generally what will happen is, you know, you run the collector, then you go for, you know, 4 or 5 states, and then you'll have another candidate for merging. And so then you run the collector again. But in practice, you get such huge savings to precision and speed that, you know, the collection time just falls out as negligible.
Mm-hmm. Haven't you just violated your monotonicity?
I've certainly violated one kind of monotonicity, which is heap monotonicity. So there's 2 kinds of monotonicity involved in this sort of static analysis. One kind of monotonicity, which I've been talking about so far, is that the transfer function f from earlier is monotonic. That's actually still going to be true. The monotonicity I have violated is heap monotonicity, or in this case, store monotonicity. Normally, it's very frequently the case that as you transition from one state to the next, the store gets strictly larger. Normally, that's the case. That's no longer the case with abstract garbage collection. So there is, believe it or not, still some benefit to actually still running it with the zero CFA and crushing all the stores together. Although at that point, you can't use a single-threaded store anymore. You actually have to do all this merging. And of course, there's ways to figure out the minimum amount of merging to do, and all that's worth it. But really, you know, if you're going to use abstract garbage collection, just use the exponential state-space searching version of CFA. There's no point not to do it.
Mm-hmm. So if some later work in the program causes it to cycle back to the same point in the program.
Yes. Yes, you still have the transition monotonicity, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, any other questions?
Yep. In this example, at least, it looks like garbage collection is equivalent to either inlining or a false stack sort of context. Is that true or not?
It is in many cases it is equivalent to certain kinds of polyvariance, absolutely. So yeah, you can very often achieve the effect with doing some sort of inlining or with switching to a different set of abstract times. So you know, if you take the zero CFA version with garbage collection and you put it against the one CFA version, they have exactly, you know, the same number of states. They do exactly the same thing. So this what this is really doing ultimately is exactly what garbage collection does for you in the real world. It takes a finite set of resources and gives you a lot more juice out of them. You know, you can go a lot further with a much smaller set because you make more efficient use of those resources over time. That's really what's going on here. So, you know, zero CFA with garbage collection will frequently crush one CFA without garbage collection in terms of the precision it gives you. So zero CFA with garbage collection, most of the time, for most applications, certainly for optimization, is all you're going to need. Uh-oh, I think my clicker died. So now what we'll move on to some applications. And first we're going to look at inlining. And inlining will motivate why we need to move up a notch in terms of precision. Let's see if I can get this clicker working. There we go. Okay, so, you know, When I started all this stuff off, one of the things I motivated it with was inlining. It's one of the major optimizations that gives you the performance benefits you expect out of a compiler. You know, inlining is hard to do in a higher order language at higher order call sites. So when people inline in a higher order language, they're doing what's called flow-based inlining. They run their analysis, and it says, at this call site, only closures over this lambda term end up there. And whenever this is the case, we'd like to inline the function if it's going to be safe. So in this case, is it safe to inline this function? Will it change the meaning of the program? No, it's not going to change the meaning of the program. It's perfectly safe to move that in there, and we'll get a small speed up. How about this case? So now we've got lambda z over y. Is this safe? Could this be safe? People think, is there ever a situation where this could be safe? Show of hands. Only one person thinks this could ever be safe. Two people? Okay. Well, there's certainly cases where this could be safe. There's also cases where this could not be safe. So let's think about possible scenarios here for when it's safe to do something like this. So one thing we want to do is first look at what free variables are in scope. So what if that y wasn't in scope at the call site? Obviously, it's not safe to inline because, you know, it's going to have a reference to a free variable. What if, on the other hand, the free variables are in scope? What if that y was in scope at the call site? Who thinks it's safe to inline then? Okay, who thinks it might, in some cases, be safe to inline? Good. It is, in some cases, safe to inline. So, in fact, in practice, every time you see the situation, it is almost always safe to inline in a functional program. It's just sort of the way functional programmers write their programs. But it is possible to construct a functional program where it's not safe to do this inlining. And this is one of these, you know, cleverly cooked up pathological examples which shows exactly why you can't do that. Programs like this don't exist in practice. At least humans don't tend to write them. But it's possible, so we have to watch out for it. So what we'll do is just sort of trace through the execution of this program and see why it's not safe to inline this lambda term at this call site, even though the only lambda term invoked at this particular call site is this one right here, and x is in scope. You know, it seems like we should be able to inline it. So when we start executing, we start execution with this application right here. 3 goes into x, false goes into h. X then flows into this predicate. It fails. And so we end up creating a closure. So the closure in this case is going to capture the value of x that's currently alive, and that value is 3. So what this closure is really doing is it's basically become a thunk, which whenever it's executed, will just return 3. So to continue execution forward, that thunk comes back, and it's going to flow out of this application point. Flows out of here and into h, and at the same time, 0 ends up flowing into x now. So now we sort of go back through. 0 comes into here. This time the predicate is true, so we come to this point to continue execution. And what flows here is the closure we created last time, this thunk that just returns 3. So at this point, we're just going to execute that thunk. The meaning of this program is 3. That's what returns. So now we have to consider what would have happened if we'd inlined. So if we'd inlined, it would actually change the meaning of this program, because this x is not going to get 3. X is now going to capture the x that's in scope. The x that's in scope is 0. So we've literally changed the meaning of this program, and it means whenever we have free variables, we can't do inlining in a higher order functional program. So we're just screwed. Except, of course, that there's a way around it, and that's environment analysis. So just to take a quick diversion here, since this is a PhD school, I want to tell you a little bit about my PhD in the hopes that, you know, my research process might help some of you. So what I'm about to show you for environment analysis is not my first solution. My first solution was published in PoP 2006 as Delta CFA. It's what was supposed to be my dissertation, but it wasn't. It was a very small part of it. It had all the hallmarks, you know, of an elegant solution, a good dissertation. You know, it really looked perfect. And like I said, it got into Popple, so it must have been good. The problem was, whenever I kept working with this thing in practice, it sucked. As I watched the abstract transition graphs unfold, you know, it would look good, 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 good. Then I'd get a little imprecision, and then it would just explode again. And it just kept doing this over and over and over again. So every time I tried to get this thing to work in practice, no matter what I did, I just couldn't get it to work. Maybe I could have gotten a sleazy PhD that was worthless. But I probably could have pushed it through. But it just wasn't sitting well with me. I wanted a real solution to this environment problem. The problem was I'd already invested 2.5 years with Delta CFA. And my advisor was just determined that this was going to be my dissertation, and I was too. I mean, it's an elegant framework, but it wasn't a real solution to the problem. And so I made the decision at 2.5 years to basically throw away everything I've done and start over. Even though I'd already got a Popple paper, even though I'd already published it in a journal, even though a good chunk of the dissertation would have been written, I just threw it all away because it didn't sit well with me. And I think the moral of the story was it's never too late to stop making a bad decision. If it doesn't matter what his pedigree is, it doesn't matter how cool it looks on paper, how much LaTeX it takes to put down, if it's a bad idea or if it's the wrong solution, it's just the wrong solution, and go for the right one. So I walked into my advisor's office one day and I said, I'm just going to throw Delta CFA away. And he looked at me like, you're ejecting at the end of the race. What are you doing here? This is ridiculous. Luckily, I followed some earlier advice he'd given me about always making sharp right turns in the right direction whenever you see them. So I sort of ignored his later advice, went with his earlier advice, and it all worked out. But it took him a month or two to see what was actually going on. And part of the problem was the idea, as you're about to see, is extremely stupid. It's way stupider than garbage collection. It's so obvious and so simple. You're like, how could this possibly do what it's about to do? And yet it does it. It fits on that much. You just don't need that much LaTeX to describe it, but it's still a good idea. So that's the end of my rant about what to do when you're flailing around in PhD school and you feel like you're on the wrong track. The answer is, get on the right one. It doesn't matter how much you've invested. It's never too late to jump tracks. So to solve the environment problem, we really have to answer two questions. What do we mean when we say environments are equivalent, and what do we mean? We have to answer, we have to find two environments in the program and say, are these environments equivalent? And then we have to define what we mean by equivalent. And we also have to define how we can pick out two environments. So we can do both of these with the environment analysis I'm about to show you. Well, equivalence is really easy to define. We'll say two environments are equivalent over some set of variables if they agree on the values of those variables. So here I'm using those original variable to value environments. And the sufficient condition for this in terms of factored environments is when they agree on their addresses. If they agree on their addresses, they're definitely going to agree on their values. So you could have environments where they agree on their values, but this condition will not catch it. But this is good enough in practice. In terms of which environments, well, we can pretend we've got this abstract state space, and we can just zero in on a state and look inside of it and ask, is it safe to do inlining in this particular state? For this particular call site. So using the machinery we've got so far, we'll look up the environment we're invoking, or we'll look up the function we're invoking. We get back to some closure over a lambda term, and it's got an environment inside of it. This lambda term has a free variable. So the question we're asking is the value of z in that environment the same as the value of z we would get in this environment? If that's true, then it indicates that it's probably safe to inline at this site. And it's totally safe if every time we see f of x, that the same condition holds true for every state in that graph. So what we're really asking is, are these environments equivalent? And we do that by pulling the environments out and looking up the free variables. In this case, we just look up z. And in this case, we get back exactly the same address. So if we get back the same abstract addresses, is it safe to inline? Who says it's safe? Safe to inline if you get the same abstract addresses. Who says it's unsafe? Okay, and the rest of you have no idea. The answer is maybe. It's maybe. Maybe it's safe to inline, maybe it's not. Okay, so here's a couple scenarios. In one scenario, that abstract address is only representing one concrete address right now. If this is the case, of course it's safe to inline. In both of these environments over z are talking about the same thing, whatever their concrete constituents are at any rate. We're talking about the same abstract address, so of course they're equal. The other possibility is that there's two or more concrete addresses represented by this abstract address. Now, if that's the case, then maybe this one's talking about the first address, maybe this one's talking about the second address. So maybe then they would disagree on the value of z. And you just can't tell. So with the machinery we've got so far, we can't tell whether or not it's safe to inline. So the moral of the story is classical CFAs can't determine the safety of inlining in the presence of free variables. There's always special cases. Like, it's like, okay, if the variables are global, then it's safe. But if it's really bound somewhere inside, then classical CFAs just can't do anything for you. You've got to go beyond. You've got to do some sort of environment analysis. And this is the really stupid idea that ended up working. I mean, you look at it and it's like, you know, so it turns out I wrote this in a notebook of mine at the very start of grad school and just sort of pushed it off to the side because it didn't seem as cool as delta CFA. But the right answer had been with me from the start of grad school all along if only I had just, you know, looked at my notebook and trusted a stupid idea. And what that idea says is if you've got two sets of addresses or two sets of anything really, and they're both singleton sets, and the sets are equal, then whatever's inside those sets has to be equal as well. It's a really simple principle. And we can you know, introduce this principle into a flow analysis without too much additional machinery. All we're going to do is keep a count on the number of times we've allocated a particular abstract address. And every time we allocate that address, we bump up the count by one. So it's all we have to do. The machinery we need for that is pretty simple. We're going to count between 0 and infinity. We don't go beyond infinity. The only weird thing about abstract counting is that infinity comes directly after 1. So once you go beyond 1, we just round it up to infinity. And then we need a component to go in every single state space called this maximum function. It's counting the maximum number of concrete constituents for any given abstract address. So you give this an address, it tells you an upper bound on the number of constituents it has. So it could be 0, never allocated. It could be 1. It's only got one counterpart, or infinity, you know, any number of possible counterparts. And to implement this in analysis, we don't have to make drastic changes to the state space. So up here in the state space, we just insert this, right next to the store, we just insert this max function. That's the only real change here. And then in the transition rules, all we do is every time we allocate an address, so everywhere you see alloc, whatever comes out of here has to be incremented in that max function. And once we make all those increments, we just install the new max function over there. And that's really all there is to abstract counting. So now we can make the determination as to whether or not inlining is safe. So we're in this state, and we want to know, can we inline whatever gets invoked here? We look up the procedure. We get back one abstract closure over this particular call site. We look up the free variable z in both the environment we found in the closure and the environment at the call site, we get back the same address. So now what we've got to do is distinguish between the two cases we had earlier. In the good case, there's only one concrete counterpart for A at this particular point in time. In the not so good case, there's however many, there's one or more, or two or more, or at least two or more. So to distinguish between these two cases, all we've got to do is look up the address in the max function. So we look it up, and if it comes back as 1, then we know the inlining is safe for this particular call site. If it's something other than 1, it's not safe. So that's all we had to do. It's a really simple idea. It works remarkably well. In fact, if you run this on most higher order programs, the percentage of variables that come back with a global, you know, lifetime maximum count of 1 is somewhere in the order of like 90%. Most variables, if you run this in addition to abstract garbage collection. So abstract garbage collection was the other idea in my notebook next to this idea before I abandoned delta CFA. If you run them together, 90% of the variables are going to have a count of 1. Inlining is almost always going to be safe with free variables. So now there's a couple of other things you can do with counting, which are kind of fun to look at. So you can add setbang, of course, without counting. But if you add setbang and then look at what you can do with counting, there's opportunities to improve precision. And this is going to end up violating that heat monotonicity I was just talking about. So again, anytime you start violating that heat monotonicity, start thinking, am I getting enough precision to make it worth it to just run through the exponential algorithm? So to add setbang, actually in CPS you add setbang then. So setbang then has a body. It's what to keep doing whenever you've actually made the mutation. So without some sort of counting mechanism, this is what the rules look like. So the nice thing about setbang is we don't have to allocate a new address, so we don't actually change the counts. All we do is look up the value we're about to assign. We look up the address of the variable, and then we just mutate the store directly. So we say whatever was at that address, now it's got this value. And for the abstract, it looks basically the same. We look up whatever value we're about to assign, and then we modify the store so that it accounts for that possibility. So unfortunately, you know, there could be multiple constituents of whatever this address is, and so we can't safely overwrite. We have to merge. So what counting buys us is a simple test that tells us when it's safe to merge and when it's safe to overwrite in the abstract. So the usual transition is we tick ahead, we look up the value, and then we do and then we figure out whether or not it's safe to do the overwriting or the joining. So if the count of the address we're overwriting is just one, it has one concrete counterpart, then we know it's perfectly safe to overwrite that this abstract address with this value. So we actually get rid of the join. This is where increased precision comes from. So the join is gone. And down here, if we can't figure out that it's one, because we get back infinity, then we have to just join. But a lot of the times, you end up satisfying this condition. A lot of the variables you set bank have very short lifetimes. Typically, they do. And so there's other stuff you can do with environment analysis. So earlier I was saying, you can only inline if only one lambda term flows there. But what if two different lambda terms flow there? You've got lambda and lambda prime. You'd still probably want to do something with this to optimize it, but you certainly can't inline. So the test you can do here is to check, are the environments inside these closures, even though they don't have the same lambda term, still equivalent to the environment at this call site? If they are, then you can take these lambdas, or these closures, and turn them just into lambdas, turn them essentially into just function pointers. Because you know that whenever that function pointer flows here, you can just pair it with the current environment. And that current environment contains whatever it needs. So you've taken wherever these lambdas are created and turned it from a heap allocation operation. You've got a malloc there under the hood, and you've thrown away the malloc. All you're doing is returning a function pointer at that point. So this is called lightweight closure conversion. And it's a big win when you can't actually inline the function. There's another really simple one you can do called globalization. So if you look over the abstract transition graph and you see that some variables never exceed a count of one, then you can just globalize them. And by that I mean, if it's an argument, you just take it out and stick it as a global variable. If it's let bound, you take it out, make it a global variable. You don't actually have to keep reallocating that every time you enter that context. Because if a variable has a count of one, or all of its addresses have counts of one, then it will never be live with an instance of itself on the stack. So globalization is safe. So to close this up, I want to take a look at an example of why it's sort of important to understand CFA. So I think at the start of these lectures, I said, it's really not enough to just download the CFA implementation from my website and run it on your compiler. You really probably want to understand what's going on the inside so that you can improve the precision or get the precision you need for your particular application. And sparse interprocedural cross-propagation is a very simple example of where this kind of additional precision comes from by working with the CFA rather than after the CFA. So in sparse conditional constant propagation, what we're going to do is evaluate conditionals as best we can and propagate constants as best we can. So as we're propagating constants, we might be able to do a better job of evaluating conditionals. So the sort of minimum amount of machinery we need in CPS to do something like this is to throw in numerals. So we've got some constants floating around the program now. And we also need to throw in a conditional form. So in addition to calls, we also have conditionals, which just, it'll just check if this is 0 or 1, just like in C, and then branch one way or the other. The state space doesn't change a whole lot. We've just got to add a new kind of value, basic values. And in this case, it's just numerals, potentially top if we can't tell which numeral it is anymore. And then we've got three rules for if. Ordinarily, in the simplest case, you'll have one rule for if. We'll just fork both directions because it's not going to try to evaluate the conditional in the abstract. But we've got information now, so we might as well try to evaluate it as we're going along. So if we're evaluating a conditional, and this condition holds true, where 0 can't possibly be in whatever this abstraction is, 0 can't possibly be represented by it, then there's no point in going down the false branch. And we might as well visit only the true branch. So in this case, it's no longer a non-deterministic rule. We only have one successor. On the flip side, if we look up what can come back from that argument, or from the conditional itself right here, and we get back just 0, then we can't possibly go in the true direction. So we only go in the false direction. So again, it's no longer non-deterministic. And In this case, we couldn't tell what happened. Zero was in there, but something else was in there too, and so we have to go both directions at exactly the same time. So this is, you don't actually need counting to do this, you just need the conditional stuff. If you don't have any information about what things could be floating around in your abstract interpretation, this is sort of the default rule. This is what you do if you don't know any better. So that's an example of why you actually want to understand how CFAs work so that you can get your analysis into the CFA itself, run it alongside the CFA, rather than wait for the results to come back. Because if you run the analysis first, or if you run CFA first, and then sort of defunctionalize and get back a first-order program, and then try to run sort of first-order constant propagation, it's too late. There's all these spurious control paths, which you could have ruled out had you simply integrated the constant propagation directly into the CFA. Okay. So what I've shown you are some techniques for computing zero CFA, chiefly constraint-solving type systems, but mostly small-step abstract interpretation. I've shown you a generic framework for CFA, where you can get lots of different CFAs just by changing the allocation function and the tick function. In fact, mostly you just change the tick function. I've shown you methods to improve abstract garbage collection, or abstract interpretation in general, like abstract garbage collection, and applications you can derive from that information, like sparse conditional constant propagation and inlining. So that concludes my lectures. I'd be happy to take any of your questions.
Mm-hmm. Focus on small step-based CFAs. Mm-hmm. What are the alternatives to small step-based?
Alternatives are constraint solving and type-based analysis and further ad hoc techniques. Those are the four categories, really. And ultimately, anything you can do in one, you can do in another, except for the ad hoc stuff. So anything you can do with constraint solving, you can basically mimic an abstract interpretation using constraints if you really want to. And then there are smarter embeddings. So if you look at the Nielsen, and Henkin book, that's a good resource for looking at constraint-based CFAs. They'll tell you how to do like one CFA with constraints and things like that. The reason I tend to shy away from the constraint-based stuff is that, you know, to go from zero CFA to one CFA, you've got massive re-engineering to do. And you sort of radically change what the constraints can look like sometimes. Or to get, you know, all these different kinds of analyses, you end up, you know, reformulating the analysis over and over and over again. With this, you just change the tick function. And that tick function, if you look at it like in Scala, like if you just find the Scala code for it, it's usually about one line long. So for five lines, you get five different analyses. You don't have to keep changing everything over and over again. It's a very efficient way to experiment with static analysis. Now, again, I say that the main drawback to small step is efficiency. If you don't implement it correctly, you get really awful efficiency. Even directly implementing that purely functional specification, which I said gives you cubic stuff, is not really cubic if you implement it directly because it's got that join in there. If you literally do that join, it's definitely not going to be cubic. It's going to be like quintic or something like that. So you really do need to use the single-threaded store if you're going to do something like that. Any other questions? All right, let's go to lunch.